are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, October 11th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks. This is a Michael Thursday on the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA, on today's program. Eric Levitz, staff writer for New York Magazine. When you protest inequality, rape, environmental destruction, you're an unruly mob, according to Republicans. When they stage an armed siege on a wildlife preserve, they're dissenting patriots. Plus, Mitch McConnell warning Democrats, don't investigate all of the myriad criminal accusations around the president or his Supreme Court nominee. Don't do that if you get in control of the House. And hopefully, Republicans banking on having enough power to give Sheldon Adelson more money. All that and more with Eric Levitz. Plus, new evidence emerging of the Saudi hit squad murder of Jamal Khashoggi, a plan that went up to the Crown Prince himself to lure the Washington Post journalist and very mild critic of the Saudi regime. The Senate is looking for an investigation, and while Trump does not like what he sees, and it didn't look good, he's very reluctant to suspend arms sales to Saudi Arabia, even as news comes in that U.S. foreign military sales have now added up to $55.6 billion, up 33% in the Trump era. Hurricane Michael was the third most intense, continental U.S. landfall on record, an unprecedented location for a Category 4. Leaving several people dead and much more destruction in Florida. Didn't stop a Trump rally, though. Senate Republicans back plans for junk health care plans, even as the CVS and Aetna merger is moving forward. And voting rights. That is the core question of the Georgia governor's race, of which Stacey Abrams really could win. It would be a historic and amazing victory. Eric Holder was there and seemed to sort of understand how power works 2 years after not being attorney general anymore, leading to the predictable Republican tantrums and double standards. Jair Bolsonaro leads going into the second round of votes in Brazil, and there have been attacks across the country, including on a teenage woman wearing a Workers' Party t-shirt who had a swastika carved into her stomach. All that and more on today's Majority Report. The team is here, minus the four-day work week man, and we are going to start with a little bit of sound. Do you remember a woman named Gina Loudon? I sure do know that Matt does.
Well, I actually hadn't, and then Brendan reminded me of this previous clip, and it all fell back into place.
It all fell back into place. See, we have to consume so much of this garbage that basically you have your core villains, your core players, your Hannitys, your Alex Joneses, your Sam Harrises.
Tucker Carlson.
Your Tucker Carlson certainly has been pretty prominent, your Bill O'Reillys. And then there's this sort of cluster of people who occasionally make do a Fox hit.
Sort of replacement-level talent.
Replacement-level talent.
Was she the TV shrink who refused to shrink for a poly couple on some television show?
Correct.
Nice, Jamie. She was also the person who wrote a book about Donald Trump's superior mental health and said this a couple of months ago on Sean Hannity.
Yeah, Trump derangement syndrome. I mean, Sean, that's what most people have called it to this point. But my book actually uses science and real data and true psychological theory to explain why it is quite possible that this president is the most sound-minded person to ever occupy the White House.
Oh, you are just, you literally liberals' heads are going to explode at what you just said.
Exploding right now. Oh. That's the fun part of the madness, is just watching them go crazy over the fact that he's really pretty unfazed by them. And I believe that. And I know.
And that's what drives him nuts.
And that's what drives them
Mike
crazy.
McCurry.
So, spoken like a true mental health professional, the most fun part is watching them go crazy. There was a piece that came out in New York Magazine yesterday where Olivia Nunzi, who's a reporter, got called into... it's fake?
No, that's real.
That's a real story. I was going to say. I thought maybe she was writing satire. Sarah Huckabee Sanders had her come into the Resolute Room, and Donald Trump sat across from her for like over an hour and had a revolving cast of characters come in just to convince this one reporter that he's not firing Secretary Kelly and that he's a great guy and everything's great and things are great. Another great example of just water off a duck's back. This guy totally doesn't think about certainly what any liberal media outlet thinks of him. Now, she also, though, did mention things like true scientific theory, which I have to be honest, I didn't study in college.
True psychological theory,
and also
Michael.
True psychological theory, which I wasn't a psych major, so I never took any courses in true psychological theory. And I don't recall the other. There were some other very serious and ominous sounding methods that she used for her book. But just yesterday, and by the way, this very rude interview with Lou Dobbs, maybe she had to swat away a grazing hand from this old bastard because he's kind of rude to her. She actually gave us a little bit more of a sense of what true psychological theory might mean in the Gina Loudon method.
Let's start, Gina.
Thanks,
with this having to subpoena Rosenstein, the stonewalling of the Congress. The president is, says he's not going to fire Rosenstein. Congress has really had a belly full.
Well, the president, Lou, whenever he's
did
doing...
Did you say hum at the end of that?
I'm just saying that I think whenever the president is doing something and it's not making complete sense to me, I've learned to sort of just wait, because the things that tend to come from that are really good. Like if we look back at what happened, for example, with the tariffs, and how he's used that as a negotiating
tool. I trust the president implicitly, explicitly. That's not really my question. My question is, why has Congress taken so long to act, and what will be the result of subpoenaing Rosenstein himself?
Well,
perhaps I should have phrased it a little more elegantly.
In the same way that I trust the president, I sort of don't trust Congress. In like the exact same way,
I like
only
countervailing
the
influences.
The flip side of that. I'm used to Congress not acting when they should be acting, and I'm used to not understanding why Congress doesn't use the power that the people who elected them have given them, and still they seem to refuse to use it when it makes the most sense. So, Lou, I'll be the last person that could ever explain what Congress is doing.
True psychological theory in action. You decide there's a person I trust, there's a group of people I don't. And then whatever the one I trust does, even if it seems absolutely unhinged and makes no sense, I know it's true. The group of people, no matter what they do, I can never explain it. And that is the Loudon method of true psychological theory. Also, when you're dealing with some nasty old prick with the most bizarre hair dye job seen this side of like Palm Beach in 1980, you go, ha, 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 ha. That was awkward.
I wonder if she's going to be on that show again.
They didn't have a nice flow together. What?
So I said wife swap.
Oh, she did wife swap.
Apparently,
too.
She was not. She was not the therapist on Wife Swap. She was one of the wives, and she was the first wife ever to walk off the set because they tried to make her swap with a poly and bisexual family. Mm. And just for people who don't know, like, you don't have to, you don't have sex with the other person's husband on wife swap. Not usually. Not that we know of anyway. So I would love to find that footage.
Gina, you're going to have to go. Gina. Listen, I'm the one you trust, right? I know it doesn't make sense.
I'm the one you trust.
Right,
I know it makes no sense.
But you're going to go have to live with that poly family.
You're going to have to live with the poly family. It makes no sense, but you trust me. It's true psychological theory. But bigger news, you don't have to have sex on wife swap. That sounds like defeating the whole purpose of the show.
No, I know.
I was like,
it's very
who
silly.
Who wants to watch that show?
That would be a pretty remarkable show if you did have
yeah, yeah. Just come back probably be compare some techniques.
Probably be some selection bias in the type of people that would consent to be on that.
True.
You know what's a really good idea? Protecting your data as you search online. Big corporations are getting rich from selling your data. And Congress has completely failed to save net neutrality or protect your online privacy. That's absolutely true. New internet providers and mobile carriers like Comcast and Verizon are free to restrict websites, spy on your online activity, or sell your browsing history to advertisers. But with one click, ExpressVPN shields your online activity from internet and mobile providers. ExpressVPN has easy-to-use apps that run seamlessly in the background of your computer, phone, and tablet. ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. Get ExpressVPN protection for less than $7 a month. ExpressVPN is rated number one VPN service by TechRadar and comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you ever use public Wi-Fi and want to keep hackers and spies from seeing your data, ExpressVPN is the solution. So haven't had it for very long. Incredibly smart move. First of all, it really is just like one click. It's very easy to install. It wasn't a big, complicated hassle, which would certainly put somebody like me who has very little patience for these types of things off. It was easy. It was simple. I was set up in under 5 minutes. And this helps with, say it's something less, that's annoying. Maybe you're traveling in Europe or Latin America. You want to watch something on Netflix, but it's only streaming in the United States. You can stream it this way. You don't have to play, you have more flexibility. You don't have to play according to those, what country the service you're paying for is rules necessarily. You can stream the show you want to stream. On the other hand, more broadly, it's obviously a really good step to take to try to protect yourself from this stalker economy. So that your, every single interest and move isn't just sort of cataloged for advertisers and for giant corporations. Make their job a little harder as they mine your life away. It's a way of taking
mess up their data.
Mess up their data a bit. It's a way of having some agency and power in this time of complete and utter lack of privacy. And so it's a great idea and very easy to install. Take back your internet privacy today and find out how you can get 3 months free. Go to expressvpn.com/majority. That's express, E-X-P-R, what? expressvpn.com/majority for 3 months free with a 1-year package. Visit express.com/majority to learn more. We'll be right back with Eric Levitz. This is the Majority Report.
That brings an oxidation is
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Eric Levitz. He's a staff writer for New York Magazine. Eric, how you doing? Thanks for being here.
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Sorry about that, Eric. Now you're here. Welcome, Eric Levitz. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, good to be here.
Eric, you, as is your way, have some very smart pieces out that people can read at New York Magazine. The first I want to touch on, and I'm going to play a clip for us that is not exactly, we'll expand the conversation, but it relates to what you're talking about. Because, well, first, there's some irony here in people like Eric Holder. Eric Holder, who recently apparently is going to be involved in a Netflix show about prosecuting big bankers, which, okay, I guess better in fiction than not at all. But this is also Eric Holder. He's campaigning for Stacey Abrams, who is running a really competitive race for governor of Georgia. She can win. The Republican Party there and her opponent specifically is aggressively going about vote purging and attempting to suppress the African-American vote, as is Republican strategy nationally. And he had this to say about how to beat Republicans. I want you to respond to that and then connect it to your new piece, Republican Protest. Republicans. Protesters are an unruly mob unless they're heavily armed and support us. Let's play this Holder clip and then I'll throw to you, Eric.
It's time for us as Democrats to be as tough as they are, to be as dedicated as they are, to be as committed as they are. Michelle always says, Michelle Obama, I love her, you know. She and my wife, like, really tight, which always scares me and Barack.
Pause. Keep her name out your mouth. All right, go ahead.
But Michelle says that, you know, when they go low, we go up. No. When they go low, we kick them. That's what this new Democratic Party is about. We're proud as hell to be Democrats. We're willing to fight for the ideals of the Democratic Party. We're proud of our history, we're proud of our present, and we're proud of the future that we can create for this country. And we're not in this just to make a statement. We're in this to win.
Yes.
All right? And the reality is, if we don't win, people who are less committed, less idealistic, less imbued with the values that make this nation really great, will run this country. Now, I see all these great Stacey Abrams t-shirts. Think about what the message would be to Donald Trump, to the nation, and to the world if a black woman, a black woman, was elected governor of this great state. Think about it. You think about how we felt about our country and how our country was perceived when Barack was elected in 2008.
Yes. Yeah.
And this would be much the same thing. Yeah. You know, this would be a rejection of all the negativism, all the divisiveness, all the racial games that they're trying to play. It would say that here in Georgia, we're better than that.
What?
You know,
yes.
We're better than
yes.
that. And the reality is, you are better than that. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, we never get our people to the polls.
Exactly.
If we vote, we win.
Yes.
It's as simple as that.
So, and that's pretty mild stuff. It's correct stuff. It's good oration. And of course, Republicans immediately had a bunch of spasms about, apparently when they go low, I guess Democrats are supposed to, help them up to accelerate the velocity of the punches into Democrats' midsections.
Yeah. I think that what you're seeing in the way that they have repackaged that Holder clip is similar to it's connected both to the way that Republicans have responded to the Kavanaugh protests by mm-hmm. casting feminists, liberals, labor activists as this left-wing mob, which is simultaneously fanatically left-wing and totally mercenary and doesn't believe anything because they're just the hired hands of George Soros who are just doing this for money. Mm-hmm. But it's connected to that and also to that sort of infamous clip of Beto O'Rourke addressing a black church about the police shooting in Dallas that Ted Cruz shared as though this were some sort of negative and revealing moment where O'Rourke was simply saying sort of what we would take as anodyne sentiments that, you know, what police officers should not be able to shoot black people in their homes at will. In both cases, it's both this demonizing of the left, but also specifically without saying that this is what they're doing, raising the specter of black political power as a tool to mobilize their bases, paranoid fears and resentments.
Right.
In all these instances, there's just not a lot that Democrats. There isn't anything that Democrats can do to stop these lines of attack. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the case that every Democrat in Congress stood up and said, you know, we revile these immigration activists who are calling for us to abolish ICE. We love ICE. We just think that it should be a little kinder and gentler. Whatever, you know, if Democrats, no amount of triangulation is going to solve the problem. Last week, Donald Trump announced that Dianne Feinstein was the lead author of an open borders bill. The reality of what Democrats stand for does not matter because fundamentally Republicans, their entire electoral strategy is dependent on portraying the Democratic Party as a radical left-wing organization that, you know, resembles something much closer to what we would wish the Democratic Party was than what it actually is.
Right. If you ever want to feel happy about the Democratic Party, watch a Republican rally.
Yeah. And so they fundamentally can't run on their fiscal agenda, which is incredibly unpopular. And they really don't even have that big of an advantage. Like if you actually put in very dry terms the culture war stuff to the mm-hmm. Republican base, a large majority of Republicans think that undocumented immigrants who've been in the country a while and haven't committed crimes should have legal status. You know, they believe that we should have universal background checks for guns. A majority think that Roe should not be overturned. There's the activist base of the party, which is genuinely conservative. But your average Republican doesn't even have on issues really that strong a culture war position. It's their fear of the other side, the other tribe. Who the Democrats are, who they represent. It's paranoia fundamentally that they rely on. And so right. they're going to campaign on that, whatever Democrats do, and they're not constrained by facts. You know, which means that Democrats, you know, the upside is that we aren't really constrained in what we do. You know, we're going to be called socialists, whether we do the ACA or we do Medicare for all. And so it's really up to us what we actually want.
Right. I want to elaborate on that in a minute because that's an unendingly important point about the Democratic Party and about broader left policy in America from domestic, I would actually argue foreign as well. But let's also further tease this out. We played yesterday on the show these great contrasting clips of Trump saying that, you know, Democrats are these extremist fanatics and, you know, apparently Dianne Feinstein and Elizabeth Warren are like Jacobins or, you know, I mean, just these kind of hysterical things. At the same time, you know, he's whipping a crowd up into, you know, they're saying lock Dianne Feinstein up, right? Like to the, you know, as Sam pointed out. So now it's just, yeah, just lock woman politicians up. The great irony and contrast of what is being projected, because obviously it's lying, but it's also obviously a massive act of psychic dissociation and projection. And you elaborate on this in your piece, because you also take us back to the occupation of the Bundy Ranch as an example, in terms of not only are Republicans hysterical and lying and unhinged about, you know, sexual assault survivors not wanting somebody who very may well have committed sexual assault on the Supreme Court, but just, you know, not only they unhinged about that, they actually have their own lane of people who really are dancing on the border of essentially, like, you know, armed insurrection, for lack of a better term. And that's fine. That's actually great when conservatives do that.
Yeah. I think that you have this hypocrisy that is, like, so blatant and obvious, but it's all operating under a consistent principle, which is just that, you know, when conservatives exercise political agency, that is legitimate because they are the legitimate rulers of the United States. Mm-hmm. And when their political opponents exercise political agency, it is fundamentally illegitimate because, you know, they are not real Americans. And I don't know if this is I don't think this is a conscious thing for most Republicans, like you were sort of suggesting, you know, don't get into this in the piece, but, you know, there's a lot of research about the way that human cognition works and the idea that the conscious mind is kind of the press secretary of the brain, where reason really mm-hmm. develops for you mm-hmm. to represent your positions to other people in a way that is going to be most well received. And so there's a natural inclination to really convince yourself even that there is some neutral principle that you're following that anybody could accept, even if they're not on your team, because it's so obvious that this neutral principle that obviously it's wrong to shout at senators. Everyone knows it's wrong to shout at senators. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm not saying this as a Republican. Anyone should believe this. But mm-hmm. but in practice, it leads to this, you know, absurd dissonance where when Barack Obama was the president and the federal government was trying to collect $1 million in unpaid grazing fees from conservative ranchers, it was not a left-wing, it was not an unruly mob for the Bundys to call to Nevada a bunch of militia members who pointed guns at federal law enforcement officials until they agreed to release these cattle that they had seized in direct violation of the law. That was not a mob, all right, but people protesting, with, you know, mean signs outside the Supreme Court after the Senate confirms a justice that a majority of the American people oppose. That is an assault on democracy.
Right.
And you have similarly, you know, that Joe Arpaio could torture people at tent prisons, some ostensibly to death, could terrorize Latino constituents, arrest journalists, organize an assassination attempt against himself in order to win re-election, defy court orders, and then President Trump pardoned him last year, and Mike Pence celebrated him as a tireless champion of the rule of law.
Right.
But Barack Obama was a jackbooted authoritarian whose, you know, excesses justified, you know, the threat of violence.
Right. And this does fit together with, you know, this broader argument about Democratic Party policy, because, as you said, maybe there was a time, maybe in the mid-90s, as much as I, you know, just reject these politics on the merits. And I think, you know, if you look into the moment, Bill Clinton's reelection campaign, welfare reform, triangulation, Dick Morris, it's going to be some of the more sort of sordid, disgusting political reading you'll ever encounter. And it also could be that there was that was a media environment, although you already obviously had, you know, with Newt Gingrich and Rush Limbaugh, and, you know, you already had this very, very extremist right that was definitely already flirting with the militia movement and had this, you know, I mean, look, Reagan had an extreme agenda of essentially just outsourcing America to corporations and, you know, campaigning on various racial and cultural resentments. But maybe there wasn't as strong an actual left then. It was a very marginalized position, and maybe there was this sort of, especially in a kind of seemingly booming economy, maybe there was this sort of suburbanite, small electorate that you could triangulate to and get yourself a winning margin in a presidential election. Oh, Clinton also wasn't good for Democrats in Congress and the Senate either. Both he and Obama really, really sort of failed in that. But my point being is that Bill Clinton was maybe legitimately able to position himself, and there might be a small electorate that really was willing to listen to the idea that well, you know, I've got all these liberals in my party and they're crazy and blah, blah, blah. And then I have these right wingers coming at me and I'm the, you know, I'm the flexible, smart centrist. In today's electorate, not only is there not an appetite for that amongst any real demographic, it's a completely shrunk space politically. You also point out that the Republican trick was, no matter what you do, we'll call it Maoism. Does that, yeah, do those kind of threads make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, I am a little more cautious on, there are still swing voters in, mm-hmm. in the world, and there are still Americans who have a vague sense of, you know, a pox on both houses, mm-hmm. and, you know, I'm going to vote for the candidate that seems like just the best guy or woman. You know, and I think there's something to like a centristy affect that appeals to some voters, but it's just the content of what we define as centrism is really open, and public opinion on a lot of issues is far to the left of, you know, what the discourse would lead one to believe. But I do think that it is true, like a constant, no matter what is happening, Republicans are going to be insisting that the Democratic candidate, yeah, is Pol Pot. And that's just like going to be an object in the room, and they're going to have a giant media empire broadcasting that narrative. And increasingly, they're going to have an incredibly compliant Facebook highlighting their propaganda. So that's just something that we're going to deal with no matter what we do. And it's an illusion to think that we can escape that by demobilizing our own base and disowning their priorities. That's not going to happen. At the same time, I think that, you know, I he's probably not going to win, but I think that Beto O'Rourke's sort of moderating an affect while running on a fairly progressive agenda mm-hmm. probably makes a lot of sense in some parts of the country. Mm-hmm. But I do think, yeah, I think that there's nothing we can do to escape these kinds of attacks.
Well, I'm wondering, maybe the distinction being that it seemed like, again, just if you read about the Clinton era, is maybe that those sort of swing voters that they were focusing on and that reflected the era were, you know, these sort of more affluent suburbanites who had some very reactionary positions and then some more relatively moderate ones and had a sort of, you know, they were concerned about the environment as an example. And they had some areas where the right was too far for them. I think today, if we looked at, I mean, what if you took, and there's so many different ways of measuring these people, but, you know, if you took, say, I don't know, you know, always that couple hundred thousand people that flipped from, you know, Obama to Trump in industrial swing states, and, you know, the ones that were actually concerned about the economy and the ones that were fed up and sort of bought the Trump scam, then it would be like, well, the sort of new era of sort of pickable swing voters that might define themselves as centrist or conservative or non-ideological, they're going to be actually really clustered around some very leftward positions on inequality, economy, and things like healthcare.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that there's something to that. I think it's, you know, it's something I want to study more, but I am sympathetic to the idea that a lot of the triangulation in the 90s that suburban voters were scapegoats for the donor class, that mm-hmm. that fundamentally mm-hmm. some moderation on economic policy that was being dictated by the party's source of funding
right.
and ties to Wall Street, the argument you can't defend in public. Well, we need to moderate on these issues because our paymasters say so, and so you concoct this idea, which you might convince yourself of as well, that like, well, we cannot compete with, clearly, you know, if you own a house and have a college education, obviously you don't want free daycare, or, you know, basically, I've grown more skeptical of that claim
right.
as we've seen in the last couple of years, polling that suggests that a lot of social democratic programs pull pretty well with affluent people, because unless you're Charles Koch, basic social goods like, you know, healthcare, college, and daycare are useful to you, even if you make $200,000 a year. But so I think there's that. I think the other big thing, though, and I think we're Clinton successfully triangulated was on racial signaling,
right,
and these cultural stuff, and the electorate has become much less white. And that's just a major, major thing in American politics, that we've seen how it's transformed California, but it's changed politics across the country, is rapid demographic change, which has made that brand of politics perhaps more potent within the Republican Party, but less necessary to compete in national elections.
Right, and I think the difference being, I mean, I think you're, of course, those the policy flows from the top down, from the donor class, there's no doubt about it. But I also think that you and, you know, this led to Clinton doing some, as I say, some really despicable things like welfare reform. Welfare reform is absolutely an attack on the poor and a very cold, you know, calculation to neutralize a very potent racialized issue by Republicans. And I do think that you had an environment then where if you're making a couple hundred thousand dollars a year, you have racialized signals on social programs, and certainly none of the top Democrats are making a counter argument about the benefits of things like universal daycare as an example. And you maybe have more of a sense of yourself as, well, I have Wall Street investments, I'm looking at this new tech economy, I feel like, you know, on the winning side of things. I think in today's environment, I think Chris Hayes really caught some of this in Twilight of the Elites. There are actually a lot of people who might still be, relatively speaking, very highly privileged in terms of that kind of couple hundred thousand dollars a year bracket, educated and so on. But they've been so bombarded with even seeing, you know, their kids diminished employment prospects, maybe seeing peers have significant downgrades in their lifestyles. I think the scale of the just incredible inequality and disproportionate suck up of resources by the top has become so concentrated and so clear that it filters to some of those, you know, upper middle class voters in a very different way. I don't know in the 90s, you know, if you would have an equivalent of when you left the sea level in at Silicon Valley, that most, like, you know, I saw one piece on, like, you know, average employee donations from companies like Google was going to people like Bernie Sanders. I don't know if you'd find the equivalent of that for, you know, an interest in a Paul Wellstone run or something in 96 from a Wall Street bank. I think it's a very different dynamic.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that a couple things have happened since the 90s. One is the discrediting of the political establishment on both sides, which has just opened up the willingness, I think, among certain voters to entertain ideas all across the spectrum that weren't in the mainstream before. But then also, yeah, these changes in material conditions. I mean, I think one of the most important political developments that we're going to be living with over the next two decades is the ascension of the millennial generation into the electorate. Mm-hmm. Generations, you know, are not using them as categories. Obviously, erases unbelievably important distinctions. You know, when you were born does not matter nearly as much as your class and race and gender. But nonetheless, in the aggregate, boomers own stuff, mm-hmm, and millennials owe stuff.
Right.
You know, and they're just fundamentally different class interests among the majority of boomers and majority of millennials. If you own your home in a metropolitan area where prices are going up, that's good for you. If you are a renter with student debt, that's terrible for you. And so I think that in terms of Google employees giving to Bernie Sanders, you know, I would wager that a decent number of those people have a lot of student debt,
right,
and that they are not, that people with their salaries in the mid-90s, you know, had much more favorable personal economic conditions than people, you know, making that money today.
Definitely. I want to just touch on briefly this is beautiful, classic Republican policymaking here. Trump has made enriching Sheldon Adelson a top goal of U.S.-Japan relations. Can you explain that?
Yeah, sure. So Japan, for the last couple of years, they've had this fight in the legislature over whether to legalize casinos. They're one of the only major nations where there is, like, no casino market. And majority of Japanese actually oppose it. They associate gambling with organized crime. They don't like it. But there are some interests who favor it. And a bill to legalize casinos appeared to be stalled, except, you know, 1 month after Trump's victory, Shinzo Abe, the prime minister, pushed it through the legislature in a move that surprised some observers. And then early in the Trump administration, basically the bill set it up so that there would be exactly 3 casino licenses in all of Japan. And so whatever casino company got one of those licenses would have a monopoly, basically, you know, a license to print money by, you know, exploiting Japanese gambling addicts. And so in the first month of Trump's presidency, Abe came to Washington, as did Adelson. Adelson met with Abe to talk about his casino, the Sands Resort in Las Vegas. Adelson gave $20 million, I believe, to Trump's campaign and $5 million to his inauguration. Mm-hmm. And so the next day, Trump meets one-on-one meeting with, you know, his counterpart, the leader of Japan. And, you know, going into a meeting with another leader, most U.S. presidents, you set diplomatic priorities. What am I going to push on? What am I going to give on? What am I, you know, going to prioritize in our negotiations? And he specifically brought up, I guess he specifically vouched for Sheldon Adelson as a casino owner and decided to prioritize it. What he's going to push for in this meeting is for the Sands Casino to get a license rather than MGM in Japan.
So this is... And this is obviously going to keep opening the funnel up for Adelson donations in the midterms, but then also presumably dumping a bunch of money into the Trump reelect. And then God knows if, I mean, maybe, who knows, but one can imagine, yeah, you know, a bunch of side conversations between Trump and Adelson too about stuff that we don't even know about yet.
Yeah, I mean, it's arguably the least concerning thing that Trump has done on, right, Adelson's behest, the moving of the embassy.
Right.
I mean, basically, there is this, you know, this insane policy towards the Palestinians.
Yep.
But then also in this ProPublica story, there's just this equally amusing thing of Scott Pruitt. Adelson has a billionaire friend who has this Israeli startup that's able to extract potable water from the air by getting moisture in the air to use like a ton of electricity. This is not a new technology. It's been around for a long time. There are lots of companies that use it. And nonetheless, Scott Pruitt made the EPA pay this company to study its miraculous technology on Adelson's behalf.
It's very promising. You should study it. So, you know, and I think I just want to put in here, and look, I mean, Ehud Olmert, who's the former Israeli prime minister, has a very, you know, he left office with massively low approval ratings. He went to jail on a corruption charge, although that, you know, my understanding of Israeli politics, I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu could very well end up in jail if Israel's still a functioning, you know, democracy for Jewish Israelis, if there's still sort of criminal accountability across the board. There's corruption probes across the board for Israeli politicians. More importantly, Ehud Olmert, like other Israeli leaders, certainly committed war crimes against the Palestinians and also against Lebanon. And he's also a very smart guy who, at the very least, understood conceptually and still understands the need for a two-state process. I don't support two-state process. I'm a, you know, full democracy, open society guy. But that being said, that is the sort of sane, you know, if you're going to be a moderate Israeli, and Olmert definitely says that, and it's self-serving, take it with a grain of salt, but it also has, I'm sure, truth to it, that a major reason why he was knocked out as prime minister right at a time when he was, unlike Barack, actually offering some actual two-state concessions to the Palestinian Authority, was because of Sheldon Adelson free newspapers in Israel basically instigating against him. And recognizing that, you know, he had become an opponent of, you know, essentially permanent apartheid in the greater Israeli project. And, you know, he's maintained that position for several years now, and it's worth reading up on. Eric, are you still there? Eric. I don't know what happened. So just lost Eric Levitz.
Hey, yeah, sorry, I'm here.
Oh, did you get another call or something?
No, I don't know. I think my cheek may have pressed the mute button on my phone.
Oh, okay. So anyways, Eric, I mean, yeah, do you have anything else to add? I mean, it's a global reach, and who knows what he's doing in Japan, you know, to correlate with this.
Yeah, no, I mean, just he's the power that the individual billionaires have over our politics is lamentable. It's potentially that there's certain ways where I can see it potentially helping the left, as far as the Democratic Party is a lot less dependent on corporations now than they were, because there's so many just individual human beings who can have somewhat more idiosyncratic views than corporations that have a more pressure to maximize their profits. So Tom Steyer and George Soros are not really pulling the Democratic Party right. Mm-hmm. But then you also have these insane reactionaries who can single-handedly poison the politics of whole continents. And you see Adelson doing similar stuff in Las Vegas. He bought the newspaper there and is using it as a tool to ruin his competitors. More broadly, obviously, there's a lot of reactionaries who are controlling a lot of the media infrastructure in this country, and it's a real problem.
Well, Eric Levitz, staff writer for New York Magazine, I really appreciate your time as always, and I always encourage people to regularly put Eric on your regular reads list. He's certainly on mine. Thanks so much,
thanks
Eric.
Much.
Appreciate it. All right, folks. We are going to go to the fun half. First, I would like to say, become a member of the Majority Report. It's pennies a day. Give Sam that psychological momentum before he goes to Politicon to confront Charlie Kirk. That will be a really hard debate.
We haven't heard anything, have we?
In the fun half, we'll discuss.
There might be. Okay. Apparently, there's a lot of there's a sort of atmosphere.
As far as we know, it's still on.
As far as we know, it's still on. But it seems that there's a sort of cuckatoo.
There seems to be a pattern of cuckatoo.
There seems to be a pattern of cuckatoo. But I don't want to project that onto Charlie Kirk. I would imagine Charlie Kirk is quite excited to defend his ideas in an open forum.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to happen.
It's a good thing he's already wearing a diaper. That's all I'm going to say.
That's so gross. Become a member of the Majority Report today. Pennies a day. Get a 5-day a week, fully independent, left, progressive show. You know what it is. Majority Report, majority.fm/become a member. Check out justcoffee.coop and all these other great ways that you can get with the show. The Michael Brooks Show this past Tuesday, Alex Breen was on, covered everything from Brazil to Bernie Sanders, foreign policy, and the long right-wing grift that's blowing up in all of our faces. The post-game was a ton of fun, as it always is. And you should also go, we're getting back to sort of building up the YouTube channel, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Go and subscribe. Lots of fun clips, including the...
Well, I was going to say, post-game was great. Preen BYOB'd.
He did. I haven't been drinking as much. And Preen was like, can I have a second? Came back with a Modelo for himself. I also like this new character of Ronald Reagan coming back from the dead, because he's pissed that Dave Rubin is using MLK. Like he's like, no, we hated him because he was black, you idiot.
He was a communist.
He was a goddamn communist. Stop trying to restore his legacy. And then, of course, that led to we played a clip where Dave Rubin said, currently, in our modern times. Yeah. And then, of course, that led to an MLK. Like, currently, in our modern times, we have an oppression Olympics. Anyways, it was a lot of fun. And we're also going to start doing some live stream events there and some live illicit histories as well, which is normally, of course, patrons-only content. And we're just shy of our first 1,700 as we go forward towards that first 2,000 patrons. Patreon.com/TMBS. Patreon.com/TMBS. Antifada. Antifada.
Yeah, so this week on the Antifada, we hosted a dialogue between our friend Dr. Jacob Blumenfeld.
Hello.
Who has a book on Stirner coming out on Zero Books.
It's a book about communism.
Oh, well, Stirner is like way crazier than that. And he spoke with Dr. Bones of the Guillotine, who has his own take on Stirner. And it was... I will confidently say I know a little bit more about Stirner now than I did before.
Stirner, German philosopher.
German egoist philosopher, yeah.
Where is that book being published?
Zero Books.
That sounds familiar.
Friend of the show.
Yeah, Zero Books. Great friend of the show, Doug Lane. Check out Zero Books. Very smart YouTube channel. And he's, of course, publishing the book that I'm writing, The Intellectual Dark Web. Holla at you, boy.
ASMR.
And actually, next week, I am going to the Jordan Peterson conference in Idaho, in Boise, Idaho. Yes.
That's what it's called?
I forget what it's called. But Richard Wolf's going to be there. Douglas Lane's going to be there. It's going to be a big... and we're going to do a pod on the anti-SJW cottage industry. We're going to be considering the material and economic conditions of the man. And I will be drinking cider.
Dun, boom. Dun, dun. Yeah, and in addition to the Stirner stuff, if you're not into Stirner, you can fast forward right through that. We talked to Jacob, who is an expat living in Berlin, about the rise of the far right in Europe and around the world.
He's living in Berlin right now?
Yeah. Yeah, he married a German lady. They just had a baby together.
Is she Jewish?
She is not. And he told me...
Wow.
He told me it's very difficult to get your child circumcised in Germany.
That's probably for the best.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, he
sorry to offend fellow members of the tribe.
It's a no-go zone.
He made it happen. That was fun.
That sounds like a movie. That would be like a Jewish Harrison Ford movie. You will not stop me from mutilating my baby.
Germany is a nine-chop zone.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah,
apologize for the Holocaust, but we don't believe in genital mutilation of the boy. You won't stop me from cutting my son. The music crescendos.
Yeah.
I like that. Are his parents pissed that he married a German girl?
I don't know. I don't think so. They're pretty liberal.
Yeah. I don't know. I remember even my grandmother one time, the neighbors bought a Mercedes, I think, and she called them traitors.
Wow.
I was like, nice.
Wow.
She kept it real.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. But yeah, anyway, we told some spicy stories. We got into a lot of trouble together back in the day. Sean and Jacob more than me and Jacob, but I was part of some of it. So check it out. Oh, we also have a bonus coming out because there was so much spicy content. We could not cram it into one episode. So that's for our patrons.
Sweet. You're forgetting one important thing.
Oh, yes. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. You can listen to it there and give us money if you want to. Also, Fans FM. It's on Stitcher. We have a YouTube page now, youtube.com/TheAntifada. And listen in your podcast app of choice.
Let me do Sam when people say their website. It's crazy. Isn't it enough to know it exists? Now you're saying the website? Just the endless self-promotion. Oh, my God. All right, Literary Hangover.
Literary Hangover most recent episode is on Corey Robbins' The Reactionary Mind. We're not only doing sort of old fiction books. We're going to do a series of books I think people should read in order to understand politics currently. So, mm-hmm. You know, Jane Mayer's Dark Money will be on there. Nancy McLean's Democracy in Chains.
Democracy in Chains might be the most important one.
That's a good book, and you can tell by how much it triggered the libertarian blogosphere.
Yes, they were very triggered.
They're
doing
a different kind of libs.
Yeah, exactly. They're the even worse ones. And so yeah, check that out if you haven't read Corey Robbins' The Reactionary Mind. We give a good introduction to it, and you should probably read that book though too. So Patreon.com/LiteraryHangover.
And there's also a Majority Report tie-in to this one, right, Matt?
Oh, that's correct, yeah. Corey Robin actually has a section of his book that sort of explicitly touches on the zero-sum nature of politics, and at least
who gets cast in that Cialis commercial?
Exactly.
That's a zero-sum game.
Yep.
So, do you see?
Check that out. If you were very troubled by the, if you get very upset by when we argue on this show and need something to sort of reconcile and smooth the waters, I think Corey Robbins' book addresses it.
But I like arguing, even when there's no real argument. That's my bread and butter, do you see?
Matt was very even-handed about it on the show. I liked it. He was just, he gave his like very chill take, like, you know, they got points on both sides, dude.
I'm the Saliza of the left.
That's pretty good.
Don't give yourself that. That's rough, man.
Yeah, man.
Don't be so.
Yeah, I also want to be paid like the Saliza of the left. So
all right,
someone can make
enough.
That happen.
All right. See you in the fun half.
Shut up! Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.
Folks, Congress has completely failed to protect your online privacy, and now big corporations are getting rich from selling your data. But with one click, ExpressVPN runs seamlessly in the background of your devices, shielding your online activity. Protection costs less than $7 a month. To take back your internet privacy today and find out how you can get 3 months free, go to expressvpn.com/majority. That's express, ExpressVPN.com/majority for 3 months free with a 1-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/majority to learn more.